RU with Sonali, and follow us on twitter.com/RU with Sonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
KBOO Portland 90.7 on your FM.
Tune in to KBOO every fourth Friday of the month at 8 p.m. for Squirrel Snow, the show where we broadcast galactic awareness, animal awareness, where we have fascinating conversations with movers and shakers in the fields of galactic awareness and animal awareness. And we play music that can raise our frequency of consciousness. Yeah, that is Squirrel Snow every fourth Friday of the month at 8 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
This is Medea Benjamin. I hope you listen to community radio, KBOO 90.7.
Welcome to another episode of Civic Cypher. I'm your host, Ramses Ja.
He is Ramses Ja. I am Q Ward. Together we are Civic Cypher.
Ain't that the truth? Stick around. We got a great show lined up for you today. We are going to inform you about a situation that is taking place in Kansas City where Black women were ignored for some time, and the consequences that, you know, people may not consider that come into play when Black women are ignored. In fact, you may not even know that this is a real thing. You know, we've mentioned it. We touched on it a couple of times on the show. We talked about healthcare disparities, you know, how
mortality rates,
maternal healthcare especially. And today we're going to be looking into policing. We actually did talk about missing while Black, the phenomenon surrounding the Gabby Petito thing, the missing white woman syndrome, where the media jumps on a missing person if she is a woman who's white of a certain age and often enough blonde. But if you are Black and a woman and go missing, oftentimes there's no coverage. So today we will be listening to Black women. This story came from our show producer, Ms. Maggie, aka Maggie B. Nolan.
She do.
And so we are going to listen to at least that one Black woman today, and bring some attention to this situation. Further on in the show, we were going to be talking about the LA City Council meeting that ended up turning racist. This is something we have to talk about. I know.
Rams, I'm just asking you. Everybody else, I'm just talking to Ramses. Do you think racist people ever get like tired of being racist? Like, do they take a break at home? Do they take a lunch?
It's got to be a full time job.
15, like. It has to be an exhausting undertaking.
I'm absolutely sure that it is. And we are going to have to figure out why this happened and a whole lot more.
Come on,
for
man.
You to stick around for. But first and foremost, Q's favorite segment. In fact, Q, why don't you take this one?
My favorite segment?
Ebony Excellence.
Ebony Excellence is my favorite segment.
I know you said that before.
You know what I'm saying?
That's why I said it.
Because...
The show be getting heavy.
I ain't mad at you. Go ahead.
And I'd be like almost crying. But furthermore, Ebony Excellence, sponsored by Major Threads, where high fashion meets timeless menswear. Visit them at majorthreads.com. And this is via thebig3.com. The Big Three is now the first professional sports league to be certified by Buy Black, the U.S. Black Chamber of Commerce, as a black owned and operated business. Shout out to Ice Cube,
yes, man. Sir.
The city of Compton. Now, just don't get me started because Rams is from Compton. I'll be getting excited. I'm going to just read.
Go ahead.
The certification establishes the league as part of the Buy Black Network and distinguishes the Big Three as the first and only professional sports league to be certified. It says, quote, myself and the entire league are honored to be officially certified by Buy Black and the U.S. Black Chambers. This is from Ice Cube, the Big Three CEO and founder. Quote, from day one, league has been dedicated to providing opportunities for black players, fans, investors, and partners, and we are proud to be a part of a nationwide network of black business owners. Supporting black enterprise is a lifelong passion of mine and the Big Three, and we will continue to build upon its success and uplift other black entrepreneurs, end quote. For more information, visit big3.com.
Shout out to Ice Cube.
Shout out to Ice Cube. I just threw up the West Side too. Yay, yay.
You know, it is one thing to play the game. It's another thing to own the board. A lesson that we've learned, and an announcement we'll make very soon.
Indeed.
All right. Moving on. Today, we have to talk about how America, and in particular, the police, continue to fail black women in particular. Now, we know that the police are not perfect, you know, but today we're going to center black women, because often enough black women get the worst in terms of outcomes, the most of the brunt when it comes to most everything, especially bad stuff. And you know, we're trying to change that narrative. You know, everything bad should happen to everybody, and everything good should happen to everybody. Everybody deserves to have a fully balanced life. If anything, only good things should happen to everyone. But you know,
that's, I mean, but if there's a group that only good things should happen to,
go ahead and say it.
Like, come on, black women.
They deserve it.
They lead in the nation and everything.
Yeah, man.
And every statistical category that shows greatness and triumph and perseverance and resilience.
Sure.
Black women are leading the nation, and we discovered recently the world, and a lot of outstanding categories: sure. Business enterprise, entrepreneurship, mm-hmm. College education,
yeah,
college
absolutely.
Graduation. Mm-hmm. Just,
and yet and still,
come on, man.
There are many, many categories that are the worst of the worst that our black women lead in as well. And these things need to be remedied because there's historical.
And that's no components. Fault of their own, by the way.
Exactly.
On those bad categories.
So we're going to tell a story here. Today's story, we're going to pull from The Guardian. Okay. This is a little get. This is a little grisly here and there, and there's some trigger warnings here. So if you are sensitive to abuse, just giving you a heads up here. So from The Guardian, a woman who escapes month-long captivity says other black women killed by abductor. That's the headline, right? A 22-year-old black woman in Missouri who escaped after a white man abducted, tortured, and held her captive for weeks in a basement, has said several other black women were killed by her captor. Less than a month after police dismissed community concerns about a serial killer as completely unfounded, the woman escaped on October 7th after about a month in captivity, still wearing a metal collar locked with a padlock that authorities had to remove. She told Kansas City police that 39-year-old Timothy M. Hazlett had imprisoned her in a basement room in Excelsior Springs, a city just northeast of Kansas City, where he whipped and raped her repeatedly. She escaped while Hazlett was dropping off his child at school, and she sought help from neighbors, whom she told that her friends did not make it out and were killed by Hazlett. Around the time she went missing, several prominent community leaders raised concerns about the disappearance of multiple black women and girls. So I want to stop right here, because this is really, we're talking about a story. You know, this is just a story. We don't really focus on stories unless they help us illustrate trends or narratives that we are trying to establish in the minds of our allies, right? So we wouldn't tell a story just to tell a story unless it was reflective of a trend. And I think this last sentence I read really suggests what we're trying to convey in this segment. So I'll read that again to you. Around the time she went missing, several prominent community leaders raised concerns about the disappearance of multiple Black women and girls. And so, if you back up a little bit further in that reading that I just did, remember that the police dismissed community concerns about a serial killer as completely unfounded, right? And so what you see here is folks not listening and Black women being kind of in the middle of it, right? And I think that this is something that is, if I were to say that it was taught, that might not be the right way to say it, right? Because no one teaches you to ignore Black women. That you don't go to a class in school, your parents don't sit you down. If you're a normal, reasonable person from a background, normal background, that's not like super racist or anything crazy like that, no one's, your mom or your dad don't sit you down and say, hey, make sure you ignore Black women when you get older. But I think that this country has a tendency to espouse certain women, look a certain way, to romanticize or, you know, amplify, angelicize certain women. And there are other women who completely get ignored. And so if I said Disney princess, what pops into your mind?
Cinderella.
Okay. Now, here's another thing. This happened to me last night. I was in a grocery store in a place called Fountain Hills, Arizona, right? And I was walking through the grocery store and I ended up in an aisle where they sell beauty products or whatever. I don't need to be on this aisle whatsoever, but I just was there. While I'm there, you know, if you know me, you know, I got all this hair. So I'm always checking for the latest conditioner because it does get a little Coco Pappy up top. You know what I'm saying? I don't know if y'all know what that means.
Man.
Nappy rhymes with Coco Paps. You know what I'm saying? Naps, Coco Paps. So anyway, so I'm looking for some conditioner, just new brands, you know, stuff I might want to try in the future just to kind of ease my way when it comes to combing and maintaining this crown of mine, right? And right next to that is the makeup. And I'm looking at the makeup as my hand is reaching for the conditioner bottles. I'm like kind of going through them. And I'm like, whoa, okay, I get it. Makeup, you're supposed to put it on and it's supposed to match your skin, right? I don't wear makeup. But you know, something just clicked in my head. I never really thought of it before, you know, but this is kind of what that makeup is for. I don't know what the name of the type of makeup it is, but it was the makeup that was the color of your it was like human flesh colored, like a whole range. And I couldn't find a color that would match my skin, right? And I was like, "What? Whoa!" Hit me like a ton of bricks. They built this whole thing without me in mind or people like me in mind. Now, I'm not a woman, so of course they didn't have me in mind. But if I was my sister, who is my same skin tone, she would not have found a makeup product that would have worked for her in that store. Now, this happened to me yesterday. I did not know that I would be telling that story today because, you know, Maggie brought this story for us and, you know, we're talking about it. But little subtle things like that here and there, I think accumulate over time where we recognize, okay, these people get celebrated, lifted up, and these other people, we don't know that they're in the shadows of our minds. You know what I mean?
Can I piggyback? Please, please. I almost say, can I push back?
No, go ahead.
But I'll say piggyback, and I think you'll get why chose one term over the other.
Sure, sure. Let's do it.
You said that America doesn't teach, or we don't teach.
You know, maybe in your
Black women, right? Okay. And maybe not in so as much as you go into a class and the instructions are to do so.
Right.
Once upon a time, I had a disagreement with my children's mother. And raised my voice. And my son said, "Dad, you can't be mean to my mom." If in that moment I don't apologize to him and her and just out of sheer ego and anger or whatever, tried to justify the way that I spoke to her, aren't I teaching him that it's okay to speak to
his
mom and or other women like that?
Okay.
So I didn't instruct him, hey, this is how you talk to a woman.
But you led
but
by example.
But in that moment, my example to him is, I was upset so I can do this. Then, okay, when I get mad, I go to my mom, to my teacher, that's how I got to do it.
Right.
So in that moment, I don't care how upset I was, I have to humble myself and I have to stop. And however her and I are going to resolve this, it can't be like that. Because I cannot tell him how much I love him or her how much I love her. Because it's not just how he feel, how she felt. If she would have said, you shouldn't speak to me that way, I can't be like, well, I'm mad. So,
yeah,
I mean, I can, but then I'm now teaching her and my son that this is the version of me they should accept. The circumstances don't matter, especially for the 5-year-old who I just tried to explain to that that was okay.
Right.
So even though I'm not giving him explicit instruction to do so, if in that moment I do anything other than tell him your daddy is wrong and your daddy is sorry, and then to his mother in front of him, tell her that I was wrong and that I'm sorry, I'd be teaching my son, hey, when you get upset, you can get that off. You know what I mean? So sure, there's not a class that says so, but when the entire society does it, everybody looks around and accepts it. Okay. We've now taught everyone that this is acceptable behavior, even
so,
if it's not explicitly instructed.
So first off, incredible example. I'm glad you shared that. That was as spot on as anything you've ever said. The next thing I want to say is that I think to your point, what we have is exactly that. We have grown up in a world, all of us have grown up in a world where we tend to run after, espouse, celebrate, whatever, things that look a certain way and ignore, step over, you know, block out things that don't look a certain way, people that don't look a certain way, right? And the way to remedy that is to discipline ourselves, each of us in our own mind, in our own paths in life, to recognize the humanness in everyone that we see. Now, I obviously am super rainbows and unicorns. That's
since the day I met him,
yeah, that's,
ladies and gentlemen.
That's me. I get
maybe
it.
One of the first things I ever said to him in front of other people, man, you really see the world as rainbows and butterflies. This was like a month into our friendship.
Yeah. That's an
old standing outside downtown in front of what's now his nightclub. But at the time we were just patrons.
Yeah.
And all of us laughed really hard because it was so obviously true.
Yeah.
Ramses does see the world with a different pair of glasses than the rest of us.
Sure.
It is to be applauded, though. I'm going to be like him when I grow up.
Yeah, I remember that night. I was doing my guitar thing, walking down the street. And then, yes, I did end up.
Taji and Bean were with us that night, too. Shout out to the fellas.
And I ended up buying that nightclub. You're absolutely right. So anyway, back to this. The crazy part about this is that through subtle things like that, like you mentioned, you know, examples of folks doing things or not doing things in front of their children and in front of each other, you know, our listener, were born into a society that just does this.
Yes.
Right? So we're not faulting you, but we are charging you with changing that, fixing it, right? A Black woman missing deserves the same type of love, exposure, etc., as anyone else. A Black woman who says there's a problem deserves the same type of response, you know, grace, latitude, everything that comes along with being a human being. They deserve that too, right? And as I read more into this story, you'll see that that just simply wasn't the case for a very long time. And the consequences of that are dire. If you are a person who believes that human life is special and precious and valuable and sacred, then you should respond to this in the same way that anyone else would. And if you've had to be led to this point to say, oh my gosh, don't feel bad, because we Black men are not immune to that either, right? I had to get into media. Then I had to do a story on Gabby Petito to find out, well, you know what? As it turns out, I haven't heard of, oh, there's that many missing Black women and Native women? Native women are go missing. We'll get to the numbers. But I didn't even know that. And I worked in media for years. You know what I'm saying? So it's not, we're not faulting anybody, but we now have, now that we know this, we have to listen and we have to hold other people accountable so that they listen. And we have to prioritize our sisters and our mothers. And you know what? I would bet my life at the end of it, when I go to heaven, that an old woman who looks akin to Dr. Westenberg or my grandma or something will be sitting on that throne in the clouds as God herself. You know what I mean? That is
not, would not surprise me
at all, right?
One bit.
And I do my best to cultivate my relationships with, especially with older Black women, accordingly. Now, I'll continue. She told the Kansas City Police, last month, the Kansas City Defender, a nonprofit newsroom, published a video of Bishop Tony Caldwell saying that he had received information that the missing women had all been kidnapped from Prospect Avenue in Kansas City. The police dismissed the concerns as completely unfounded, saying in a statement, "There is no basis to support this rumor. The case is just the latest example of a predominantly white police force refusing to take seriously reports of missing and murdered Black, brown, and indigenous victims, especially women and girls." Now, I want to take a moment and shout out the Kansas City Defender. There's a very special individual who founded and runs that. We had the pleasure of sitting down with him and talking with him. His name is Ryan Sorrell, and he is a person who fights the good fight. If you get your news about the country or, you know, anything like that, I know it sounds like Kansas City and you might not be in Kansas. In fact, I'm not sure that we have any stations in Kansas. So you definitely aren't in Kansas if you're listening to this.
Or Missouri.
Please search out this publication, because it is not just Kansas. It is just an awesome voice to have. And it is a national publication just based in Kansas, has since gone national. Kansas City, Missouri. You're right. So this next part comes from NPR. Kidnapping investigation raises new questions about reports of missing Black women. The NPR interviewed Ryan Sorrell at the Kansas City Defender. And the reporter asked, "What is the hope of the community about where this investigation is going to go from here at this point?" And Ryan said, "They did not reach out to us to ask where did we get the information. They didn't reach out to the bishop that initially made the video. They didn't reach out to any community members. The Black community generally was silenced in essence because of that. And so that was also deeply concerning to us. And that is another aspect that is deeply troubling about the situation. To be frank and honest, we are doing investigatory work ourselves because that's truly how this information came about. And it was from us in the community." In other words, no police support, no police help. You know, police departments have like investigators and detectives and that sort of stuff. Well, the Kansas City Defender had to be their own investigators and detectives and so forth to get to the bottom of this story. And it's not to say that that hasn't happened elsewhere, but we see things like this happen in Black communities, which is why Black media is very important. Which is why listening to Black voices is very important, you know, because the power structures that exist in the world exist to support the movement of money. And at the end of the day, the movement of money benefits the wealthy. And for those of us who cannot see that, we think that these things exist independent of cases like this. And the truth is they ignore things like this because it doesn't serve their ultimate agenda, which is to keep people with money and power in those positions. Almost nobody knows that. It's the wildest thing. Now, I do want to share some statistics with you. So this comes from CNN. According to a 2021 FBI data report, Black people make up 31% of missing persons reports, but only 14% of the U.S. population. Okay, so that means that Black people go missing nearly a third of Black people make up the missing persons report, only 14% of the population. White people,
or to say that again, a third of the people missing
are black. That's what I'm trying to say. Sorry. Thank you. White people, meanwhile, make up 54% of missing persons reports and 76% of the U.S. population. So black people go missing at higher rates, you know, proportionately.
At an insanely higher rate.
And some black families are still searching for answers even after their missing loved one is found. Like, how did this happen for so long? And a lot of times after a very long time, if you find a missing person, the circumstances are not good anymore. You just find them, you know, they don't get to pick up and continue. The FBI's National Crime Information Center says the largest disparities among black people make up about a third of active missing persons. And those numbers look like this: 29,357 people versus white people, which is 50,544, Asian 2,109, and Native Americans, which is 1,554. And also the NCIC includes people who identify as Hispanic or Latino in the white category. In other words, this is a real thing. You know, we're not just talking about, you know, the people that go missing at higher rates, but we're also talking about the people that don't get listened to, they don't get reported in the news. And when that happens, I think the result of that, rather, is that if you were a predator, you would perhaps prey on the most vulnerable.
Yeah.
The people who are least likely to get a strong reaction from the news, strong reaction from the community, strong reaction from those with power and influence. Oftentimes, people with power and influence don't look like us, but the victims of these sorts of kidnappings and, you know, this type of brutality, they look like our women and children. They look like Native women and children. They look like, you know, marginalized groups. And so, again, having a bit of empathy, giving a bit of a voice, and listening. This is about listening to black women. And this is kind of been the charge of this whole segment. Listening goes a long way. And we mentioned healthcare, and that's another one that, you know, and there's a lot of people fighting that battle on that front. And so, again, we just thought that kind of bringing this to your attention today would certainly help paint the picture a bit further than we've been able to do before. So,
and now, proper propaganda. Watch it. Pull my mic back. You like that? Journalists, we're journalists too. We can strike back. Hardcore reporters with orders from headquarters. Behind enemy lines, sidestepping the borders.
With that said, if you're just tuning in to Civic Cypher, I'm your host, Ramses Jha.
Yes, he is, and I am Q Ward. You are listening to Civic Cypher.
Mm-hmm. Still got a lot more show to stick around for. We will be talking about the LA City Council meeting that turned racist, unfortunately. We knew this day was coming. And we have to talk about it, you know. And I think this honestly, it makes me glad that we have this show, because no one else can give it in these spaces. No one else can give it what it needs in terms of like, hey, we really need to address this. We can't just sing and dance our way through this one. We have to actually talk about it. So we will be talking about that. We also are going to be talking about Mahalia Jackson for our Way Black History Fact, and how she sparked Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech. And that's a really cool story that Maggie B. Noen wanted us to talk about. So first and foremost, let's discuss how to become a better ally. BABA, today's Baba, is sponsored by the Black Information Network Daily Podcast. You can find that on iHeartMedia or at BINnews.com. We are having discussions and interviews on topics and news stories important to the Black community. Today's show comes from our very own Ms. Maggie, a.k.a. at Maggie B. Noen on IG and all platforms.
She do.
So she wants you to learn how the media system fuels anti-Black racism. Interesting. All right. So there's a great place to check out at freepress.net. It's by our friend Colette Watson, exploring how the United States' dominant media system has propped up racial oppression throughout history and continues to today. And we invite you to check it out. As an active ally, understanding this history of harm perpetuated by the U.S. news and media industry and the solutions for modern media justice today is critical. Make sure you are fully informed and best poised and positioned for constructive allyship in action. Content is king in many ways these days. Now more than ever, representation and diversity in all categories of information is invaluable, as is your comprehensive support. Your eyes, your ears, your clicks, your reviews of these platforms and publications all matter, and so do your dollars. Black News and media entities like the Kansas City Defender, Media 2070, Free Press Sheen Magazine, and of course, us here at Civic Cipher. Your donations, your downloads, your subscriptions, your purchasing our products and services, all of these actions go a long way. And I'll add sharing as well and letting
yes,
other
indeed.
People know. And on behalf of all Black News and media, we extend our gratitude and appreciation. So normally we have something else, but that came from Maggie, and I kind of love it.
Thank you. Yes, you're indeed. Far too kind.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's get to it. LA City Council meeting turns racist. All right. I'll start by reading. This comes from the LA Times. Headline reads, racist remarks in leaked audio of LA council members spark outrage, disgust. Behind closed doors, Los Angeles City Council President Nuri Martinez made openly racist remarks, derided some of her council colleagues, and spoke in unusually crass terms about how the city should be carved up politically. Martinez made racist remarks about council member Mike Bonin's young son, while others chime in during this section of the conversation. The group was discussing a dispute between council members Kieran Price and Marquise Harris Dawson, who were at odds last year over whose district would represent USC and Exposition Park once the new maps were finalized. During the conversation with council members Gil Cedillo and Kevin De Leon and Los Angeles County Federation of Labor President Ron Herrera, Martinez described Bonin at one point as a little B-word. Martinez also mocked Oaxacans and said, F that guy, he's with the blacks, while speaking about Los Angeles County District Attorney George Gascon, who was another council member. De Leon appeared to compare Bonin's handling of his child to Martinez holding a Louis Vuitton handbag. De Leon said Bonin, who is white, is like the fourth black on the council and implied he wouldn't stand by Latinos. The conversation took place October of 2021 and focused heavily on council members' frustration with maps that had been proposed by the city's 21-member redistricting commission, along with revealing cruel, racist comments. The leaked audio offered a rare window into the behind-the-scenes machinations of the redistricting process and the bare-knuckled fighting between various groups trying to secure political power. Okay. Now I'm going to take a moment and I'm going to talk about this. So, I'm from LA.
City of Compton.
Yes. I grew up around Black people and Mexican people. I have no aversion to Spanish. I'm a little unique in that way because my grandmother was from Cuba, and my first language that I spoke was Spanish. Don't ask me to speak it now, but if I needed to, I could get by. Don't worry, I just sound like a three-year-old. My cousins, blood cousins, Juan and Tanisha, identify as Hispanic. Their mother is Black, but their father is a Mexican man, and they both visibly look to be more Hispanic. That's not to say they don't claim, you know, both sides. It's just, you know, that's the way the world treats them. It's just kind of how that goes. I have two sons. Both of my sons are half Mexican. I know you're going to want to add that, so go ahead and add it.
As are both of my children. Okay. Half Mexican.
Okay. And my childhood memories, my friends, then and now, and well into the future, will all be mixed up. And that will include a not insignificant at all amount of Hispanic, Latino people. So it's like family. It, and it literally is family. You know, my son, my, you know, like my, you know, literally family. And then, you know how I am with my friends, that, you know, when you're in, right? So this is the man who is going to give his thoughts. I need you to know that, because I'm about as close as you can be to something like this, and not myself be a Hispanic person. I also am as close to this as you can be, because I do this show, I walk this path, and I am a Black man. And I also recognize what California wants to be. Again, I'm from this place. I was born in 1982. So the first part of my life, everyone seemed to get along fine. Later on, these huge increases in the prison population because of the war on drugs, because of, let's be honest, Clinton's policies.
Reagan, Bush, and Clinton.
And Clinton, yeah. But, you know, during, you know, that time. But you're absolutely right. Reaganomics paved the way for all of this, hence the war on drugs. And other factors, you know, created a boom in the prison population. My brother explained this to me one day. I have an older brother. His name is Raka, Ira Science of the Dilated Peoples. They make the music for the show that you listen to every week. The rappers, that's the Dilated Peoples. And so my brother is, my literal brother is in the group. And he told me this. He says that, you know, what happens in prisons is folks tend to link up with people who look like them.
Yeah, very, very tribal.
Right. And it's just how it is. It's really difficult to get away from that. But what happens is, you know, that environment is not the natural state of human beings, right? We are not meant to be in cages like that. And so our behavior, our social skills tend to evolve in a very strange way when we are put in an environment like that. It is not our natural state. But what happens is some of those people get in there and learn how to hate, become radicalized. This happens with our brothers and sisters from the Caucasian tribe as well. And what happens is they bring that, now that that prison culture has gotten so big in, you know, the late 80s, all throughout the 90s and early 2000s, and even now, that prison culture ends up spilling out into the street as people tend to, you know, rotate back into society.
And or attempt to anyway.
Right. And so you have prison politics in an environment where people in theory would be free from that, be freer to be who they naturally would be, freer to make children, as my aunt and uncle did, who are mixed race. My uncle by marriage, his name was Romero. I love that guy, man. I haven't seen him in some years, but he was so cool, man. He wore a cowboy hat. He was like real, like macho, you know, he spoke Spanish, and he was a G, man. Anyway, and just be free to be who you are, celebrate your culture alongside other people who are celebrating their culture and not hate it, right? What happens though is that prison culture diffuses through communities and even works its way up to city council meetings, as we're seeing now. Because I don't believe that is the natural state of the Los Angeles City Council. We're talking about the late 1800s, early 1900s in New York City, when there's, you know, Italians and that sort of stuff. I could see that a little bit more easy. But somebody who comes from Los Angeles, this feels very bizarre. Seems like you got something to add. I can learn.
No, we can learn. And I think that's a large part of not just what our audience gains from the show, but what we gain from it. Having these conversations forces us to become more informed, more learned, and more educated on the topics that we cover. And if you listen to this show before, you've heard us speak about this, Just like it's hard to not bring racism into these conversations, it is impossible to not bring up the impact of capitalism on these conversations. When the resources are scarce and people have to fight over them, just like in prison, people become tribal. They can in city council, where they're, you know, redistricting and drawing maps to decide who's going to get money. Let's call it what it is. Drawing those maps and reconfiguring the districts. You know, the reason why we're fighting over who gets USC, because USC's district is going to get more money, right? So when you create a situation where the resources are scarce and people have to fight over them, people who would otherwise get along and thrive together now feel themselves pitted against each other. So that's why you hear that language about, you know, he's probably going to side with the blacks, meaning the neighborhood where the black people lives will end up getting more money if that person votes that
sure,
way.
Sure, sure, sure.
Right. So when you create these circumstances, not just in city council meetings, not just in prisons, but in neighborhoods and in cities, sure, and in this country where there has to be have nots and the haves have so much, everyone else is left to kind of duke it out over what remains.
Okay.
From schools, our education system, to city councils, to government. I mean, our government has been so polarized and so divisive and, you know, so partisan that we no longer agree on anything, like the definitions of things that have been fact our whole lives, because in order for my team to have the power, we just got to ride out on the other team.
Yeah.
And some people who really don't benefit from their team winning have been so, you know, and so put into this tribal, divisive,
tribalized
partisan mindset.
Yeah.
They're going to ride for their team no matter what, right, so that their team can win, even if that doesn't benefit them in any way. So these situations, we talk about the rate at which people go to prison in poorer communities, also tied to the scarcity of resources. Mm-hmm. The reason why some people don't go work at the places where you and I have worked before media was a thing and get on the corner and do what they feel like is a faster way to get more money, even though it's more dangerous and less safe, and the chances that you're going to end up dead or in prison are high. Mm. I got to get this money however I can, because my kids and or my parents might not be able to eat or go to the doctor if I don't do this.
Yeah.
So we create the circumstances that lead to black and brown people fighting each other, because I'm trying to get this money for my district and I don't want the blacks to get it over there. It's really, really a sad thing, but it's very, very impossible to ignore that capitalism, just like our prison industrial system, have a lot to do with these outcomes.
And I'm glad you said that, because you're absolutely right. Capitalism at the center of this is an awesome take on it. And it is painted more vividly when the social climate is underscored with basically a prison population problem, right? Overly incarcerated imprisonment rates or something like that. I forget the term, but it's something like that. And it's a big deal around the country. We definitely have the highest prison population in the world, but we have like something like half the prisons are prisoners on earth, yeah, or something,
our
are in the
per
US.
Capita incarceration rate,
yeah, is insane. Yeah. So
out of this world.
And we also have high police shootings, every mass shooting, all this sort of stuff. And, you know, there's a lot of things that I know this is very naive of me, and it's an oversimplification of how to address these sorts of things, but the quote unquote one man, one vote approach to pretty much everything would change quite a bit. You know, if someone were to run for, you know, president of the United States and that was their platform, listen, I'm really going to change this country for the better. Let's do one man or woman, one vote, and we can shape this country in the way that the people really want it to shape it. Then you would have something that really reflects a democracy. Now, I recognize there's some people that are like, people don't know what they want, people are stupid, whatever, that sort of thing. But at least we would have a better idea of what it is that people truly want. And it would eliminate these sort of this fighting, bickering, gerrymandering is a big thing that we push back against on this show, because the Black vote has been disenfranchised. Black political power has been challenged at every conceivable step in the political process in this country since it was first permitted. And, you know, we see that those challenges are uglier than ever now heading into midterm elections, which, by the way, I voted today. I voted early. I sent my ballot in. And if you are not voting in the midterm elections, then you need to sit on attack. All right. All right. I was going to say something else, but I'm not going to say that. Okay. I'm going to keep reading, because after this was exposed, there are people on the city council who have still not resigned. You would think that's the first thing that you do. I've embarrassed myself. I've embarrassed my people. I've shown my hand. I've exposed a very ugly side of, you know, this process. And I was supposed to be the great solution. And I, you know, whatever it is that you would go through in terms of your soul searching as you came to terms with this disgusting behavior being made public, right? But I'll read, and this comes from NPR. Two LA city council members have lost their committee positions over race scandal. All right. The head of the Los Angeles City Council stripped two members of much of their power Monday to pressure them to resign for participating in a private meeting in which they did not object to a colleague's crude and racist remarks, and at times joined in the offensive banter. Acting Council President Mitchell Farrell removed Gil Cedillo and Kevin De Leon from committee chairmanships and assignments and named them instead to a board that rarely meets, as he turned up the heat on the veteran Democratic politicians. Quote, "These members have lost all credibility, all standing," O'Farrell said at a City Hall news conference. "By losing committee assignments, their influence in City Hall has dwindled, and they have largely become token figures unable to participate in the day-to-day work of the council and unwanted in council chambers where their appearance is likely to cause an uproar. The council has moved to censure Cedillo and De Leon, but doesn't have the power to remove fellow elected officials from office unless they've been charged with a crime. Latinos, who make up nearly half the city's population, only had four or just over a quarter of the 15 seats on the council at the time. Black people, who made up less than 10% of the population, have three, a fifth of the seats." So we know that the main woman who, we don't use her name, main woman who was, you know,
almost all of the audio is her.
Yeah. And she said in Spanish that, you know, the little Black boy was a monkey, or acting like a monkey, something like that. She has resigned. She stepped down. But the other folks, again, who are participating in this and encouraging it, you know, or did not move to stop or otherwise correct the behavior.
Very, very willing, laughing.
Sure. No, I get it.
Participants. They sure weren't lookers on. They weren't passive in it. They were. They joined in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So they are still technically on city council. And again, this is one of those things where it's like kind of hurtful. You know what I mean? It's one thing if like you make a mistake and you just take your lumps. It's another thing if you choose to stick around and remind everybody of exactly what you think of them. You know what I mean?
And the really interesting part for those who kind of joined in, I was at work. I won't say when and I won't say where, because I don't want this story to be about anyone specifically but me. And in absence of anyone being present from the party that was being made fun of, I was there and I heard it, and I did not defend them. And I felt like a coward. I felt like fraud, because I like to think, and I think all of us have this version of ourselves that's heroic. If that would have been me, I would have
That'd have been me.
That'd have been me. We all think that, right? But just like when someone tried to kidnap my son, a moment of pause could have led to him being taken. Because you think if someone tries that, I'll jump over this car and I'll, that's what you think. But when I turn around and I see this man reaching into my car to grab my son, I freeze. And once again, I feel like a coward, right? I bring these examples up because I can not just forgive or sympathize, but empathize with someone who does not, who is not biased for action when something wrong is happening. We all think we would, right? But in the situation I was in, it would have required me to challenge someone who probably could have fired me from my job. And you and I have both shown the world that there's only so far you can go where we will just say, forget this job and walk away.
Yeah.
What this person said on his face, if I typed it out, wouldn't be offensive. But if you were standing there and you heard the joke, you know for a fact that it was offensive, but it was offensive to parties that weren't present. So there was no one there to speak up for them except for me in my mind. There's 10 of us there, so anybody could have said something. But in my mind, the person that should have said something was me.
Yeah.
However, if I laugh at or join in on this joke,
it's different.
It is a degree further.
That's different.
It is a few degrees further, and it's beyond cowardice.
Yeah.
You're just as much as at fault.
Right.
As the person that you're allowing to get off this hate, this racism, and this divisiveness.
Yeah, it's being complicit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In those moments, I apologized to people that I knew who should have been represented in that space. Moreover, my children and their mother.
Mm.
So to paint a picture of how serious this was. And when they heard it, they're like, oh, that's no big deal. But to me, it was a very big deal.
Well, I had to learn those lessons too. And I'm happy to say that more recently in my life, I have spoken up, not laughed. And if I can do it, you can do it too. And so can these people. But first, they need to step down and take their lumps.
Absolutely.
All right, let's move on. Yo, LA, we love you. Y'all figure that out. Okay.
I'm throwing up the West Side again.
Yeah, we love you. Okay. Hispanic people, Mexican people, Latinos, Black people,
white people, Asian people.
Say it all.
All right. Original,
yeah.
Asian,
say it all. Go ahead.
Other, if you check that, we love you too.
Yeah. And we all in it together, all right?
Stop all that. I just wish everybody would feel that way.
They're going to feel it eventually. All right. Today's Way Black History Fact, sponsored by Hip Hop Weekly Media. This comes via biography.com. How Mahalia Jackson sparked Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech. Here we go. Long before his famous 1963 speech in front of the Lincoln Memorial, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. had a dream. He talked about the dream that the previous April at a 16th Street Baptist Church meeting in Birmingham, Alabama, of, quote, seeing Negro boys and girls walking to school with little white boys and girls, playing in the parks together and going swimming together. He continued that dream at a Cobble Hall speech in Detroit. Speech in Detroit that June that he hoped Negroes would be able to buy houses or rent a house anywhere their money will carry them and they will be able to get a job. So for his biggest audience at the March on Washington, he didn't think it was worth dwelling on the dream on that hot summer's day in the nation's capital. In fact, the dream wasn't mentioned in the notes that laid atop the podium, and it wasn't in the plans for that day. Then gospel singer Mahalia Jackson, whose life was portrayed in the Lifetime original movie, Robin Roberts Presents Mahalia, changed the entire course of one of the most famous speeches in American history. Probably the most famous. I think I'd give it that.
I'd give it that too, without hesitation.
Jackson had grown up singing in church and found mainstream success, paving a path for gospel music outside of churches. As an international star known as the Queen of Gospel Music, who had sold out her Carnegie Hall concerts in New York City, she attended the 1956 National Baptist Convention, where she first met King. Soon, King started asking her to join him at civil rights events around the country. She put her career and faith on the line, and both of them prevailed. Jesse Jackson, who first encountered the singer in the 1960s, told NPR, as the granddaughter of an enslaved person, Jackson was committed to the movement, contributing financially as well. quote, "I have hopes that my singing will break down some of the hate and fear that divide the white and black people in this country," unquote. She had said that that mission was surely met, as Jesse told NPR. Quote, "When there is no gap between what you say and who you are, what you say and what you believe, when you can express that in song, it's all the more powerful," unquote. When it came time for King to choose a singer to perform at the Washington, D.C. March on Washington for Jobs and Reform, King quickly turned to Jackson. He requested that she sing the black spiritual song, I've been buked and I've been scorned, which she passionately performed to the more than 200,000 people, setting the tone. Understanding how much was at stake with the speech, King had started initial discussions about what he would say at the August March back in the spring of 1963. Even with all that advanced planning, 12 hours before the speech, King still wasn't sure what he would say. Everyone had a different take, saying that some felt it should have an ideological and political reform take, while others felt it should lean more toward a church sermon. With so many different opinions, King asked his team to draft up an outline. They came up with an opening analogy of African Americans marching to Washington, D.C. to redeem a promissory note or check for justice, and no mention of a dream. When the team gathered again, the group started debating further about the elements that were missing, but King simply took the notes and headed back to his room, leaving them with, "I'm now going upstairs to my room to counsel with my Lord." On the day of the now famous speech, soon after Jackson's rousing performance, Jones still didn't know what King was about to say when he stepped up to the podium. He started out with the bad check analogy that Jones had written. When he finished the promissory note analogy, he paused, and in that breach, something unexpected, historic, and largely unheralded happened. That was when Mahalia Jackson spontaneously shouted, "Tell them about the dream, Martin. Tell them about the dream." At that moment, everything changed. Sure enough, King went completely off the books. He was speaking spontaneously and extemporaneously, and his whole body language shifted, became more relaxed, and then as some Baptist preachers do, he would take his right foot and started putting it up against his left leg. Some preachers do that as they're talking, and he began to preach. Inspired by those words from Jackson, King turned back to the dream. Instead of looking down at his notes, he spoke from his heart, engraving that famous dream into the American history books. "I say to you today, my friends, even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream," he said. "It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal." The more he spoke about the dream, the more people felt the message. And now the speech itself is best known as the "I Have a Dream" speech. Later on, King addressed the impact of the moment. Quote, "When I got up to speak, I was already happy," unquote. He wrote to Jackson on January 10, 1962. He continues, "I couldn't help preaching. Millions of people all over the country have said it was my greatest hour. I do not know, but if it was, you more than any single person helped to make it so." In that same letter, he said she was a blessing to me as well as a blessing to Negroes who have learned through her not to be ashamed of their heritage. As for Jackson, it was in her very nature. "But what can we do but help each other?" she once said in an interview. But she goes on, "I don't go to these meetings that do a lot of blah, blah, blahing. If you're going to blob, put your money up there and do something." And that she did. So, I'll be honest, I didn't know that.
I've never heard that story in my life.
Shout out to
as a massive fan of Mahalia Jackson and of course of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
Real quick, I need to say this. Shout out to Maggie B. Known for uncovering that gem.
I've been trying to tell you that.
Yeah, I've been listening.
B. Known.
She does, man. She knew this one. So listen. But wow, very powerful. And I think that this was perfect for today's episode. I listen to black women.
Marty Mar, listen.
Thank you. And this nation should live up to its creed, to its ideas, ideals, and at this, I think that this speech and this take on the speech certainly, it's just very emotional. It's such a hurtful thing to be from California to hear what that lady say that stuff. That was very hurtful for me, and I'm proud of myself for having made it through it. So we'll leave it right there. How about that? What a heavy show, man.
Aren't they always?
They are always, but man, that, like, LA, that's home. I mean, we, you know how there's certain things that hold up your world. Like, hey, man, listen, we got each other. You know, we got to teach these folks, you know, but we got each other. You know, when that gets rattled, it's a little scary. You know what I mean? But we'll make it. And we are walking our path, and we hope that you are walking our path with us, or walking your path toward the same goal. With that said, thank you for listening to Civic Cypher. I'm your host, Ramses Ja.
He is Ramses Ja. I am Q Ward. This has been Civic Cypher. Please, folks, subscribe, like, comment, share. Be a better ally, please.
And check out the store at civiccypher.com. Shout out to our producer, Ms. Maggie, aka Maggie B. Mellon.
She do.
I think that's about it. Until next week, y'all.
Peace.
We handle it. These brothers are fabulous. Dilated, showing you where rhyme travel is. Worlds are spittoon from sunlight to moon. Bussing off stage like gunfight saloons. Pull my mic back. You like that? Journalists, we're journalists too. We can strike back. Hardcore reporters with orders from headquarters. Behind enemy lines, sidestepping the borders. With press passes, we bring it to you as it happens. The streets love my crew for music and rapping. Street commander / beat expander. Here to fight the slander with the proper propaganda. What's happening? You got a question, then ask it. The news is just a TV show. Get past it. And this from a quiet wartime journalist. Headlines. Wake up, refuse, and resist. Like this. Like this. Like this. Like this.
Okay, you're listening to KBO Portland. Shout out to all the Black Portlanders. They exist. I'm one of them.
Dr. Zom's Stereo Obscura. Offbeat sounds for talented listeners. Broadcasts every other Wednesday at 10 p.m.